when you think about the NFL, the Premier League actually has more fans than the NFL. Formula One has more fans than the NFL. But the NFL does an incredible job. And most American sports in general, I think the Western world is known for this from other countries around the world, is they monetize the asset really well.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to another edition of The Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt. I'm your host, Andrew Brandt. We are ably produced by Brian Neal, music producer Sam Brandt, my son's got some great music out now. You hear it below us. And this week we are presented, as always, by DraftKings and a special guest. We're going to get to him right away. Joe Pompliano is a guy that I discovered about a year ago who's putting out great content on sports business like me, but we're kind of in different lanes on sports business. He does these great info newsletter type postings on Twitter and, of course, his newsletter, which I'll talk about. We go through threads on social media about different topics. I've learned a lot from him about F1 and about Bitcoin and about NFTs. So I've been on Joe's podcast as recent as last week, and he's had me come on, talk about my background and talk about issues in the news and the NFL business side. And now he's returning the favor. He's coming on my podcast. I think he's fascinating. I think his story is one worth hearing from everyone. And I think he's another slice of the sports business world that everyone listening to my podcast should know about. So without further ado, my guest this week on the Business of Sports podcast, Joe Pompliano. As I mentioned, I've been wanting to have Joe on the program a long time, and I'm honored that he's had me on a couple times, and now I can at least return part of the favor. Joe Pompliano is someone that I got sort of aware of through, I don't know if I told you this, Joe, but actually through my students. I teach sports law and sports business, and it was a couple of years ago where my students are like, you know this guy Joe Pompliano? I'm like, I got to say, I don't. And they said, oh, my God, he's great. And he does these Twitter threads, which at that time I didn't know what that was, on sports business topics and sports law topics. Of course, these were sports law kids, law students. And I'm like, OK, I got to find this guy. And I did. And your everything is advertised and so much more. So anyway, great to have you on the program and great for what you do in our collective space of sports business. Welcome.
Well, I thought my intro was pretty good when you came on my show, but that was well above and beyond what I did. So I appreciate it. And I'm happy to know that some of your students enjoy the content also.
Why don't we start right there? How did you start doing these threads? And because, as you know, I'm very active on Twitter, but I kind of limit it to my 140 characters. And rarely get past the first one in these sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 thread kind of things. You've kind of made it an art form over the years. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think we probably have to go even a little bit further back, which is why I started doing this in general. And I'll give you the summarized version, but the short version is that I grew up with four brothers, so five of us in total. We played every sport you could imagine growing up, basketball, football, baseball, et cetera. So I thought I wanted to be in sports forever. I thought I wanted to be an agent. I worked at Octagon Sports Agency. I did an internship there in college. Mm. And then I got an opportunity to go work up in New York City for JP Morgan. So I quickly realized when I was at Octagon, maybe I don't want to be a sports agent. There was kind of some things about the business and so forth that I wasn't necessarily as excited as I might've previously been. And then I got the other opportunity. So I took that. It was a great job. I was there for 4 or 5 years. But I sat down one day and I said, hey, is this really what I want to be doing, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now? And I just had a moment where I really came to the decision that it wasn't. And I wanted to combine the two in some degree, both sports and business, because I was always talking about these things, whether it was my girlfriend at the time, my brothers, family members, friends, et cetera. I was always talking about these topics. So I started writing the newsletter while I was at JP Morgan. And really the Twitter stuff was just an avenue to get more people to notice it, right? I was taking basically my newsletters that I was working pretty hard on, right? It was daily. So I was doing a bunch of research already and I was just constructing them in maybe 8, 9, or 10 tweets. And then at the last one, I would say, hey, if you enjoyed this, you should sign up for the newsletter because this was in the newsletter today, right? And that was a very good avenue early on to grow subscribers and grow followers. So once I realized that it worked, I just doubled down on it. I got to a point where I was doing literally maybe 5 or 6 a week, one essentially every night, for 6 months. I did over 100, and they take a lot longer than I think people imagine. anyone who has tried to do one can attest to that, I'm sure. But they take a few hours at a time, and you obviously have to do the research beforehand. But really, it was a growth tactic, and I realized it pretty early on that it was working. So I just got really aggressive and tried to do it as much as I could.
So you're at JP Morgan, and I didn't know this about your background. I was going to ask about that. So you're in the sports agent business, by the way, Octagon, I know very well. They've represented me. I know a lot of people there. And you transitioned to, was it money management? Was it investment portfolios? And did you go to New York, one of the big JP Morgan? So how did that transition go in, and how did the transition go out?
Yeah, it was pretty seamless, and I actually really enjoyed it a lot. I was on the wealth management side, so you're essentially managing money for individuals or families or kind of smaller LLCs or organizations, and I was on the fixed income team. So they split it out between trading desks kind of on the quality of the credit that you're actually trading. So it was just research and trading for fixed income bonds, and I did that for you know, several years, and you work your way up. I think most people that are involved in finance know this very well, but for people that don't, there's a very structured path in finance, and specifically at places like JP Morgan, where you start out as an analyst, then you get promoted to an associate after a few years, and then a few more years, you get promoted to vice president, and then you get maybe executive director and the managing director, and maybe something else from there, right? You get a leadership position. But I made it to associate, and that's when I kind of thought everything through. And I'm like, hey, you know, this is very structured. You're sitting on the desk, you know, JP Morgan, they have desks that are 10 or 12 people long, and there's just like 100 of them, right? So there's a million of them. And you're sitting next to people that are 2-3 times your age at this point. And we're all kind of doing somewhat similar things, right? That maybe they have a greater degree of management or leadership or responsibility, but you're all kind of doing similar stuff. And that's when it hit me like, okay, I really have to be okay with doing this 40 years from now, if this is what I want to do. Which is why I laugh when everyone's like, oh, you know, you got to pick what you want to do when you're older, you're 21 years old, you're 22, like start your career, get going. And I think all of that's important. But I think it's more important probably to find something that you're willing to work really hard at. Because when I told JP Morgan I was leaving, a lot of them didn't get it. Obviously they were like, you know, you're writing a newsletter. Are you a writer? Are you a journalist? And I was like, well, I'm going to create content. I'm going to invest. I'm going to do all these different things. And it's worked out well now looking back, 2 years now. But at the time they certainly didn't understand it. And I think that the part that they really didn't understand, and probably I didn't even understand at the point, was how hard it was going to be, right? I worked, way more hours when I left than when I was there. And you hear about JP Morgan, I think most people in finance and even outside of it think of it as this like very demanding job. And it is. Right. But the point is that the other stuff was more demanding. And when you go out on your own and you're trying to build this, build a content business from an independent perspective, it's really difficult. So you have to be willing to put in the work for sure.
It resonates so much with me as I talked about on your podcast, where I left this high paid, high prestige job at the Packers and moved into media and academia, and much harder, much more work, but much more rewarding for me. And people, again, like JP Morgan, you think that you're the Packers, like working from 8 to 8 every day. You're there, but you're not doing a lot of stuff, at least from my position. Once the contracts are done, once the team's set, you know, I didn't do a lot of hard negotiating or work. So it just depends on what your sort of lifestyle interests are and your needs. And yes, these jobs are hard, but they're sort of passion plays. And speaking to that, so you get into doing this newsletter, can I say basically full time, and then take us where your career led.
Yeah. So up until I started, I was always interested in investing in private businesses, right? So my brothers and I all grew up interested in the business side of these things. And when I was at JP Morgan, it really just got expanded. So we were exploring, I would call it, things on the digital side in crypto. And we were investing pretty heavily on a personal basis in Bitcoin at the time. So I ended up leaving And the thought process was very simple, actually, when I think about it now. It was to have a content business that's personality driven and independent, so irrespective of kind of every other entity, and use that as an interesting flywheel to work with sponsors and partners, but also leverage that to get deal flow for investments, right? So I started the newsletter when I was at JP Morgan. I probably did it for maybe 3 months or so. I was up to, you know, it looks smaller now, but I know it's significant, 10 or 15,000 subscribers when I left. And I convinced the sponsor to basically pay me a monthly fee for 6 months at a time. And I said, I'm going to give it 6 months. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. If I hate it, I hate it. I'll go back to what I was doing or something similar. But I'm really going to have a go at it. And I quit and started doing the content stuff full time. And obviously, you have the ability now to work many more hours or focus on it much more when you're not at JP Morgan or somewhere similar. So I was creating a lot more content. I was doing more of the threads. I was writing better newsletters. I was trying to market it better. I was tweeting more, all of these things. I was showing up on podcasts. I was really trying to get the word out there. And it grew a lot during that time period. So after 6 months, I found more sponsors and the business started to grow from that capacity. I've since hired more people. But that's also enabled me now to build this platform where I have the ability to not only work with people on a sponsorship level, but actually invest in a lot of these businesses, because there's this interesting flywheel that's created now where they want me involved because of the audience, right? I have the ability to work with people and tweet about their business, write about their business, podcast with the founders about their business. And it's very clear, right? I always make it exceptionally clear about kind of my involvement within these situations. But I also think it's super interesting because then I'm able to have conversations or talk about things that maybe people wouldn't see elsewhere. And I would say that the other part that was extremely helpful and something I'm very cognizant about is the personality driven side of it. I think that when it comes to sports business for sure, but just media in general, people can get news from anywhere, really, when you think about it. And you have to think about kind of what is different. How do you make yourself different than everything else that's out there? And for me, I'm always very conscious of the ability to provide opinion. So when people sign up for the newsletter or people come to Twitter or people listen to the podcast, I'm very clear, like, hey, there's going to be some personal opinion in here. I'm definitely biased because one of my core thoughts and thesis is like everyone's biased to some degree, right? It's impossible not to be. But I feel like people would rather if you're just honest and upfront about yours. So I tell people kind of my thoughts on certain situations. I relay the news for sure, but then I always provide some kind of personal opinion, which I think has been helpful because it provides people the avenue, whether they love it or they hate it, it's just different than everything that's out there. So I think that that's been really important. But look, I'm very very fortunate at some of the things that have happened. I obviously appreciate people that read and listen to this stuff and follow me on Twitter because now it's my full-time job and it's extremely fun.
Yeah, again, we're kindred spirits there. I think what we both agree is that not only personality driven, we both provide the information, but then we layer on our editorial insights and perspective that are gained from knowledge and experience. That's what people want to see. And I think we have similar followings due to those reasons. And what's really interesting, you and I talk about this all the time, is sports business maybe used to be just a tiny niche where it wasn't really out there. Everyone just wanted to talk about the games and wanted to talk about who's going to be the best player, the best coach, et cetera. And now it has expanded so much. And people like you and I are able to have spaces that are generally in the same genre, but very different. As you know, I focus on league and players and contracts and more sort of that side. And you're in a more, I guess, general space in the business of sports. And we both have, you know, plenty of opportunity to live side by side, which is great. I mean, I guess I want your thoughts on the expanding interest, which is great for us in sports business. I remember, I'll just give you this little anecdote. When I'm at ESPN, I was there for 8 years after Darren Revelle sort of started the space. And I said to one of my bosses, like, you know what, in addition to me providing in all these other shows, maybe we should have a show. You know, we should have a show, like a half hour a week, business of sports, business of football, business of whatever. And he said to me, I won't name him. He said, you know what, Andrew, 12 people will watch that show. And I'm like, okay, that's your opinion, but look where we are now. Look at the popularity of your newsletter, my popularity, Revelle, others, etc. So I just think that's a statement on where we've been and where we are.
Yeah, there's a bunch of even publications now that cover solely sports business, right? They're only focused day to day, and they have hundreds of employees combined collectively that cover this stuff on a daily basis, whether it's professional or amateur or collegiate. It's become a massive business. And I think that's a mistake that a lot of people make, irrespective of the industry necessarily. But people go into things thinking that these niches, or what people would describe as a niche, at least initially, there can't be multiple winners. There can't be people that succeed at the same time. And I actually think it's the complete opposite. I think that if you work together and everyone has a good relationship, you can drastically expand the market, right? Because people have different approaches. They think about things differently. Their content style is different. The way they deliver it is different. And I think what I found over time is that my platform, it started out what I thought was very niche. I always thought, you know, like, if it doesn't have the money in it, if it's not the business of the sport, like, I'm not going to talk about it. And I tried to stay super focused on that and silo myself in that arena for a period of time. And what I realized over time was I'm actually providing for a much bigger group, right? It's people just like me who find these things interesting. And now when I create content, I only ask myself one question. And the question is, do I think this is interesting? Right. And my bet is that there's millions of other people in the world that are just like me and want to talk about these things, whether it is how much Kanye West made from his hoodies at Gap. Right. Like, that's something that no one would ever think about. But you see it and you talk about it and all these people care about it because it's interesting. So it expands beyond sports, I think. I think it goes into culture. I think it goes into film, television. Like, it can go anywhere is my point, really. And I think that generally, people just drastically underestimate how big niches can be when you start to expand outside of that. And I think sports business is a perfect example, because we went from Darren Rovell convincing ESPN, the worldwide leader in sport, to cover it on a regular basis, to now there's multiple and several publications that cover it every single day. They have reporters, they have editors, they have staff, they have marketing, they have sales, they have all these organizations. And it's really expanded, and it's great to see.
Yeah, it's awesome to see. I want you to take our listeners inside. We haven't even mentioned the name. If they're watching, of course, they see it on your shirt. Huddle Up is this great newsletter. I'll let you plug it, of course, but 55,000 and growing, just an incredible subscriber base. But as you said, it's a lot of work. As someone who writes a weekly newsletter, I know how hard that is. And every night, every day, you doing the same. Tell us sort of the formulation of each day's newsletter and your process, your day-to-day in getting that out there.
Yeah, to be honest, I get asked this question a lot. And I think people are shocked about how simplistic the approach is, because when you think about a daily newsletter, it's truthfully a lot of work, right? You have to obviously do the research component of it, and you have to craft your ideas and thoughts and your opinion, especially when you're providing that in context. But then there's so many other things that go into it too, right? It's all free. So it's monetized through sponsorships. So you're working with sponsors, you're making sure all that's in place. Fortunately, I have help, right? So I have several people who help me on a daily basis with not only the sponsors and everything like that, but research now and other things. But really, I pick something that I want to write about. It's generally something that's similar or kind of closely related or recent in the news. And I pick a topic. I do kind of some quick research, maybe 10 or 15 minutes, read it, make sure it's interesting, try to find some supporting evidence around my first initial opinion. And then I do more research, whether it's later that night or the next morning. And then typically I write it in the morning. So it goes out every day. It goes out around 9 to 9:30 every morning. I wake up early, obviously, maybe somewhere between 5 and 5:30. And I write it and I send it out and it's done. And then I don't think about it again until that night. So it's like become a routine at this point, where again, it's time consuming. It takes probably 3 hours plus each newsletter, from research to kind of topic formation to opinion formation to actually writing the content. But it's become routine at this point, and it's something that I'm used to a degree.
And how do you account for your growing subscribers? Are you marketing this in certain ways to get more subscribers? I know, obviously, both of us, you know, we're very active on Twitter. Anything beyond that?
No, to be honest, I haven't done any paid marketing or any kind of thing ancillary to that too. I've done a couple newsletter swaps. So I've had people reach out to me and say, I know we've done this and other people have done this, where you basically put your link in someone else's newsletter and they reference your link. And that's actually a pretty good way to grow initially if people are starting newsletters and want to get their first few hundred or first few thousand subscribers. Highly recommend that because there's thousands of people that are in similar positions and want to do the same thing. And you can really leverage each other's audience. But again, the easiest thing for me, or I don't even know if it's the easiest, but the thing that made the most sense was Twitter. And I realized that if I could just continue growing the follower on Twitter, that would be kind of the top of the funnel. And then I can move people elsewhere, right? So the Twitter, I did 1.2 billion impressions last year, and I should do significantly more this year. But that allowed me to gain, I'm up to 375,000 followers now when we record this. And what I do then is I filter them down. I say, hey, if you follow me, I know you have some general interest in sports and business or crypto or whatever it is. So you'll probably enjoy this newsletter too. And maybe you get 5%, maybe you get 10%, right. Maybe you get 20%, but there's certainly a number of people that will flow through. And then from there too, you can do other things. So now I do the podcast, I do content on YouTube and elsewhere, and you promote it to the same audience. You know that they're interested and you use this as kind of like your home base. And then you build out Instagram, you build out these other channels. So you're not as reliant on that. But for me, the holy grail, if we'll call it, has always been Twitter.
And are you, I think we talked about this offline, you are not a one-man shop anymore. You have a staff, because you're talking about a lot of things going on here, you know, with sponsor activation and sponsor delivery and talking to sponsors and getting new sponsors, etc. I would imagine they want to talk to you, but you have to clear your plate of other stuff. So tell us about how you've grown in terms of personnel.
Yeah, I think it's funny when people, I hear podcasts all the time and people act like they have it all figured out to some degree. And I think the one thing that's important is like, I'm still working on it myself and trying to figure out what the best way to do it is for sure. So I'm very careful to give people advice on exactly how to do it. But I think for me, I am very hands-on on a lot of these things. I want to make the final edit. I want things done exactly how I do them. I want the thumbnail to be made by me, right? I want the description in the comment to be made by me. I want the title to be made by me. And I'm very hands-on. So I've had a difficult time doing that for sure. But to answer your question, I certainly do have help now. Yes, I convinced my girlfriend at the time, now fiance, to come work with me about a year ago. And she handles, luckily, all the sponsorship stuff. So she's in charge of talking to the sponsors on a daily basis, making sure that we have the contract signed, we have the invoices sent, we have the assets that we need, both from a copywriting perspective, an imagery perspective, everything like that. So that has taken a lot of stuff off my plate. I certainly help with kind of the calls and stuff like that, as you mentioned, but that's helped tremendously. And then I have someone who helps out with video content. So they help me edit all of the podcast. They help me with the video components. They help me with the Twitter clips and stuff like that. And then I just got a third person who is going to help more with all of the research stuff. So research for the newsletter, research for podcasts, research for video clips and so forth. And he'll manage a lot of the growth stuff and the YouTube and everything like that also. But again, I think it's just about finding ways to leverage your time, right? Because when I think about what I do in a day, there are certainly things that are super valuable to me. And then there's things that are less valuable. Yeah. And this applies to everyone, right? You, people listening, anyone that is creating content or doing anything really for work. And you have to find out what those high value things are or the high ROI items. And you have to spend more of your time doing those things, right? So content's an interesting business because especially an individual run content business, because if I don't record a podcast, it doesn't get recorded. If I don't do the YouTube clip, it doesn't get posted. If I don't post a tweet, it doesn't get up, right? So you have to spend your time doing those type of things. Otherwise they don't get done. And then it's just finding ways to leverage your time for different situations. And again, I'm getting better at it day over day, but I certainly wouldn't be able to accomplish anything that I've accomplished without the people that help me out on a daily basis.
You know, spring is finally here. Omaha Steaks makes it easy to stock up on all your favorites. You can visit omahasteaks.com, enter Brandt, yes, my name, all caps, B-R-A-N-D-T, in that search bar. Order the Omaha Steaks sampler today. You'll save over 50%, plus you get 12 Omaha Steak burgers free with your order. The package can have all of the mouth-watering butcher-cut filet mignons to the delicious caramel apple tartlets. Every order is backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee to deliver perfection in every single bite, every mouth-watering bite there is. Visit omahasteaks.com, type keyword Brandt, in the search bar order today. Listen, there's a reason why Omaha Steaks has been the leader of gourmet steaks for over a century. No one, I mean, no one comes close to matching the flavor, the tenderness, the value that you get in a box of Omaha Steaks. Fifth generation owned and operated, they invented meat delivery, and they're still the very best. You can sincerely trust Omaha Steaks to deliver quality worthy of their name. So again, visit omahasteaks.com, type in keyword brand, order the Omaha sampler today. Omaha Steaks, the best in delivery meats.
The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
I like to talk to successful people like yourself about routines. You talked about getting up early, getting your work in, getting the product out relatively early in the morning. Talk about your routines in the rest of the day. I mean, are there non-negotiables for you? I mean, I'm talking personally, I know, such as exercise, maybe meditation, maybe time with your spouse, to-be spouse, those kind of things. What goes on in your world that maybe you can impart to our listeners?
Yeah, I think routines are very important. And if you asked my fiance, she laughs at me sometimes because I do the same thing basically every day. A lot of times I eat the same meals. I wake up the same time, go to the bed the same time, do all the same stuff, right? And I think some people think that that's wrong, but I think it's actually very helpful to a degree. I think that it makes me do less decisions in a day, and I don't have to focus so much on specific things, and I can focus on the work. So yeah, to answer your question, I wake up very early relative to what people might expect for the newsletter. I wake up at 5 or 5:30 in the morning, have coffee probably earlier than I should, sit down, I write the newsletter, I make sure the podcast is going up and everything of that sorts. And then throughout the rest of the day, it's a mix of various things. So content is certainly one of them. I record a live show every day for 2 hours. I record usually a podcast, maybe two a day. I do Twitter, obviously, and other things. But then I would say that a few of the non-negotiables are reading, for sure. I think that one of the most important things that, I don't know if people generally skip over, but I saw myself being less aware of, was just education, right? And I think to do a job like this from a content perspective, you constantly have to make sure that you're staying on top of things from an education perspective. So probably an hour or two a day just to make sure that I am kind of unbothered education time from a reading perspective, podcast too, stuff like that. Exercise for sure. We have a dog, so walk the dog every day, same time, and so forth. But yeah, I think the routine is important. I don't think I do any, like, everyone always talks about like life hacks. I've talked to many people about meditation. I've heard it's unbelievable and it's great. I don't do it, but things like that, you know, I've just never found the time or made the time to do it necessarily.
And you mentioned your brothers growing up with a lot of brothers. I assume you're Italian, big Italian family. And your brothers are very, very out there as well, or at least a couple of them on Twitter, having expertise in finance, having expertise in investing. Do you do stuff together with them? You all have your own little siloed empires separate, or tell us about the familial bond there.
Yeah. So my older brother actually kicked this off probably a year or two prior than when I started creating content. He was creating content about things, again, that we were talking about at home, which was Bitcoin and finance and investing and all of this stuff. So he started a year or two before me. And now we do similar things. The newsletter, he does similar. He does a podcast also. We do YouTube content. And then, but where it all kind of comes together is on the investing side. So we were investing both personal money, but outside capital from investors, right? So we raised a fund and we're investing about $20 million a year in total in this rolling fund that he initially started in maybe 2018 or 2019. And we returned all that capital later on and we said, hey, look, it's probably just more fun and beneficial instead of like having this big headache where we have to talk to a bunch of smaller investors or people that we don't necessarily even know to some degree. all the time and updating them on what's going on and all these things. Like, why don't we just do it together? So last year we actually closed down that fund and we opened a family office. So it's incredible because now we get to invest together. We pool our money together and we invest in businesses together. And again, it's helpful because not only do I have the platform, but two of my other brothers are active on Twitter to complement what you said, and they have podcasts and so forth. And we're able to create this nice business where we share kind of some resources on the back end from a content perspective of editors and things like that. But ultimately, a lot of the value comes from working together on the investing side. And anyone that has multiple brothers, or at least has a good relationship with their brothers, will tell you that it's awesome. It's amazing to be able to work with them on a daily basis.
Where'd you guys grow up and where are you now?
We grew up in North Carolina. We grew up in Cary, North Carolina, for anyone that's familiar with the area, right outside of Raleigh. I was born there. Two of my other brothers were born in Florida, but when I was born, we lived in North Carolina. I moved up to New York City after school, and then I moved down to Miami. I'm in Miami now. I moved down to Miami a little bit over a year ago. So 6 or 7 years in New York and now Miami.
What brought you to Miami? Besides the weather.
The weather is certainly part of it. Yeah. It's interesting because when I left JP Morgan, you have this realization that you're not necessarily tied to a geographical area anymore. Yeah. Because you don't have to go into the office, especially in the work that we're doing. So my older brother moved down to Miami probably 4 or 5 months prior. My fiance now and I went down to go visit and we liked it, and we got office space and everything. So we figured, why not? We'll try it for a year and see how it goes. And we've really enjoyed it. It's been great. Part of it is a little bit unfortunate because we have some family that's still in New York and New Jersey, and we certainly try to see them when we can. But yeah, to your other point, which is the weather is awesome. There's a very good, I don't know if vibe is the right word, but there's a very good feeling down here right now. Yeah. With a lot of people moving here out of cities that they were traditionally in for work. And now that everything's kind of been opened up and decentralized to a degree, they have the ability to move elsewhere. And I think Miami has been a big beneficiary of that. And other cities have also, for sure. But when you just think about geographic location, like, you know, there's 8 or 9 million people that live in New York City. It's a very small area. If you don't have to work there, then yeah, there's probably a lot of people that are going to move out. And same with LA and San Francisco and Chicago or any major city. And I think Miami was a big beneficiary of that because of the weather and everything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a post-pandemic thing that's going to last in terms of people realizing they can be anywhere, not necessarily completely work from home, but just understand that there are other places. You don't have to go into a cubicle every day or even an office. I want to talk about two content areas. I mean, you cover so much in your newsletter, way beyond stuff that I do in terms of, again, leagues and teams and NFL and football, basketball, baseball. One area that you talk a lot about, and you obviously have a great background in, is crypto. Now, you know crypto way beyond the sports space, but talk a little bit, if you will, about crypto in sports. I guess you can take this anywhere you want to go, but sort of NFTs were kind of a big thing. Maybe are they still? Should they still be? We have a little fraud involved in there. And then, of course, the league's aspects towards crypto. It seems like NBA is always kind of an early adapter in that area. You just had something on the NFL being tentative in that space, but slowly jumping in. So talk a little bit about crypto and crypto in sports and where these leagues are in their acceptance level.
Yeah, it's funny to me because I was seen as like an expert, I guess, to call it, from the sports space when it came to crypto, because yeah, I had personally been investing in it for years at this point. And it was something that I was intellectually curious about and interested in, and invested a lot of not only money, but time into learning. So I had been very in tune with kind of what was happening on the Bitcoin side for 4 or 5 years when all of this really started happening in sports. And the thing that's interesting to me is, like, I never saw it expanding to what it is today. Not necessarily Bitcoin. I always thought Bitcoin was going to be very, very, very important, but I didn't see the NFT space coming like this. I didn't see all these sponsorships coming. I mean, to a degree, it's obvious now, but it's just been really unique because I was always solely focused on what I'll call like one specific asset of the area. And now it's expanded all these other things. And I've forced myself to really gain an understanding and education around it. But when I think when it comes to sports specifically, I think we've seen a few things. So there's certainly a lot of stuff that's happened on the NFT side. My personal opinion is that the technology or the thesis behind NFTs is very interesting and very cool. I think that the mistake a lot of people make is that they think that it is the end all be all. The truth is that you can get very, very, very close to what an NFT is through a centralized and a private database, right? You can essentially run a database for a company and get something very similar. Sure, there's maybe some nuance behind it that's different, and certainly that's true. But for what most people are doing, I think you can do it in a traditional sense. And that leads me to say that probably 90 to 99% of the stuff out there right now is being shook out, right? It's gonna be determined if it's worthwhile or not. I think the people that have done well are ones that have taken a cautious approach. And I think we've seen this in general with sports. There's certainly tokens and businesses that have gone alive and gotten adopted in Europe. And we've seen a lot of them, sponsors have been removed, tokens have lost value, and fans have lost money, players have lost money, leagues and teams have lost money, and so forth. And I feel like the approach has been different. Europe has been very aggressive in a lot of this stuff, and the United States has been much more reserved. And what instead has happened here, I think, is the right approach, which is it's certainly been a little more cautious, but it's much more from like a legitimate sponsorship perspective. So if you think about the largest exchanges in the world, everyone has probably heard about them by now. Coinbase, Crypto.com, FTX, these are all exchanges, right? So they make money whether the price goes up or down, et cetera. People are trading these assets on their platform. So they're the ones spending all of the money because, right, when you're building the business, the most expensive area at first from a marketing perspective is acquiring customers. So initially they go out and they market to all of the finance folks, right? If you're interested in investing, you're probably going to be interested in crypto to some degree. Whether you believe in it or not, you'll at least understand it and you'll know kind of what's going on. Then the second avenue, and Sam Bankman-Fried, who is the CEO of FTX, has talked about this a lot, which was they ran a bunch of data, and all the data basically shows that sports fans are 2 to 3 times more likely than any other avenue to be interested in crypto. So then what do? You go start pushing all your marketing dollars towards sports. So FTX was really the pioneer in this space. And now we've seen some add-ons with crypto.com and others. But over a year ago now, I think it is, that FTX bought the naming rights to the arena in Miami. They sponsor another football field for Cal in California. Right. Crypto.com has sponsored the UFC. They're doing Formula One. Coinbase is the official partner of the NBA. And these are billions of dollars of contracts, right? So again, it makes sense because the business has exploded. Bitcoin is now, I think it's a $750 billion or $800 billion asset class. We were above a trillion last year, but the total market is certainly above a trillion or 2 trillion at this point. So this has grown up a lot in the past 3 or 4 years. And that means that exchanges have made a lot of money. So now they're spending all of that money to acquire new customers, et cetera. But for the leagues, it was an interesting avenue because they had just come off the pandemic, right? And they lost a bunch of money. Each of these leagues lost over $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion from not having fans in attendance, from losing sponsorships, from losing some of them lost TV rights. And obviously you want to recoup some of that money. So you're willing to kind of go further out on what we'll call the risk curve when it comes to sponsorships. These aren't your Budweiser and your Bud Light companies or whatever. You know, you're taking a little more risk, but the dollars are worth it. And then ancillary to that, I think it's going to continue and even get bigger because one part of the equation for sure is they have a lot of money to spend. But two, this is a completely new revenue stream for these leagues, right? The NBA is a perfect example. They did a deal with Coinbase where Coinbase is now the official crypto partner of the NBA. That's a sponsorship category that didn't exist before.
Right.
You know what I mean? That they weren't getting paid a dollar for that before because it literally didn't exist. And now it exists and they're able to go sell that inventory. So when you're able to add kind of more surface area on an inventory level, it makes a lot of sense that they're willing to go further out on the risk curve for some of these items. Again, I think like some of these are going to be good deals and some are going to be bad deals. I think everyone's always cautious about like, oh, this is the smartest thing to do. This is the best thing to do because ultimately like no one really knows. This is going to take years to play out in some scenarios. But I think that it makes a lot of sense at least as to why we're seeing it play out on such a large scale.
That's really interesting. Yeah. I mean, new category, you mentioned Bitcoin, new category. Sports betting is the same thing, right? There was no official casino of anyone. There was no official sports betting partner of anyone. And now leagues, teams, media, everyone's involved in it. It's really interesting. The other area I wanted to get your thoughts on, because you and I have talked about this, I didn't know Formula One from baby formula, like until that Drive to Survive. It Netflix series has drawn me in like so many others. And I read your newsletter and see the incredible popularity in this country and around the world of F1. it's caught me in. It's only 20 drivers. There's a lot of drama. It's all these superstars, Lewis Hamilton, etc. And it's coming there where you are in Miami in a couple of weeks. So you tell us what you see from a business case study point of view with F1, maybe specifically with Netflix or even beyond that.
Yeah. So I guess the background is helpful, which is that Liberty Media bought Formula One, the series, and they paid about $3 or $4 billion in cash, but the enterprise value on the business was 7 or 8 with debt. So they allocated a substantial amount of money towards the series. And the easiest way to think about it is that Formula One is a massive sport globally. It wasn't here in the United States, and it still isn't to a huge degree the biggest sport, but it's a massive sport globally. The average race had above 90 million people watching each race, right? And wow. For context, the Super Bowl gets 100 maybe, right? So globally, it is a massive sport. But it was super undervalued and under-monetized given the leadership. So there is this gentleman named Bernie Ecclestone who used to run Formula One for years and decades. And there's this famous quote that he has, and I'll have to send it to you after this, but essentially the gist of it was he didn't care about younger fans because their sponsors were UBS and Rolex and expensive companies like that. And he's literally quoted as saying, what do these kids know? They can't buy any of these products. I don't care about kids. And today that sounds idiotic to some degree, right? Like it's just completely opposite approach of what every other league is doing. So when you think about the NFL, the Premier League actually has more fans than the NFL. Formula One has more fans than the NFL. But the NFL does an incredible job. And most American sports in general, I think the Western world is known for this from other countries around the world, is they monetize the asset really well. So these are kind of just made up numbers, but say the NFL has one fan, they earn $4 off that fan every year. For Formula One, it was like 50 cents per fan, right? Mm-hmm. And it's completely different. And maybe those are overgeneralized to a degree, but you get the point. So Liberty Media buys this business and they turn it around. And what they've done is a few different things. One, they made the racing closer. So they changed some of the rules. So the cars are now much more competitive than they used to be. There's usually one or two teams at the top, but Mercedes won the title for 8 years in a row. Right. And to some degree, that gets boring to some people, right? They don't want to see Lewis Hamilton winning every single year or Mercedes winning every single year. And the car plays a huge part of that, right? So you have to make it more competitive from a competition standpoint. They've done that. The cars are now, they've changed some of the rules and the racing is much, not only cleaner, but competitive. So that was part one. Two, they redid their entire inventory and sales sponsorship packages. So they used to sell, hey, we have three tiers, you're buying one of these and that's what you get. And it was like a very basic cookie cutter approach. And now it's very customized, right? Like every other sports league does. So maybe you get this asset one race, you get this asset another race, you're paying for this on another race, et cetera. And everyone kind of gets a unique custom package. And what that enabled them to do is monetize it to a much greater degree. So they've done that and they've made a bunch of money and expanded the revenue from that capacity. Next is the Netflix series. So the Netflix series has been huge from a US perspective. I joke all the time, and initially when I said this 2 years ago, people laughed, and I don't think anyone laughs today, but the Netflix series, Formula One should be paying Netflix, right? And it's the other way around. Netflix pays Formula One for the content. And I say that because it's brought billions of dollars in economic value to Formula One, right? If you just think about where the sport was years ago, Formula One, it was on in the 90s and the 2000s, but I think it was 2010 to 2012 or 2014, somewhere in that range, kind of early 2010s. Formula One wasn't even in the US. There was no races here. And they took it away and it wasn't popular at all. They were averaging like 300,000 or 400,000 viewers per race. Just no audience at all. IndyCar spawned up, NASCAR spawned up and got very popular. And what we've seen is now Netflix has been that content vehicle that has allowed them to reintroduce the sport to America. And I think what they've done so well is obviously the content is great. You get to see the drivers, you get to see the inner workings of kind of the garages and the paddock that you normally wouldn't see elsewhere. And you really learn about a lot of these people, the rivalries, the teams, et cetera. So that's very important. And that has allowed them to expand again in the United States, right? And when you think about, again, the Western world, we're able to monetize these events much better than anywhere else. It's the largest economy in the world by far. Sports fans are willing to spend more money. They're interested in these events, et cetera. So we have a race in Austin. Last year in Austin, even with the pandemic, was the largest F1 race in history. I think they had 400 or 450,000 fans attend the 3-day weekend. And that's the other thing they've done really well is they've turned the events from kind of just the race to these massive parties now. So there's DJs, there's concerts, there's all these events around it, which has turned it into kind of like festivals. But now They're doing Miami this year. So you mentioned it's early next month, 2 or 3 weeks away now. They're doing that race. And then they just announced another in Las Vegas. So now they went from having 0 races to 3 races. Yeah. And that's more than any other country in the world has now. And I think that Netflix obviously has a huge part to play in this, but I think it's also just going to get bigger. When I mentioned earlier, there was 300,000 or 400,000 people watching. Even 2 years ago, there was 500,000 people watching each race. This year, the first 2 or 3 races have averaged 1.2, 1.3 million viewers. And ESPN does the deal for media rights. And they were paying, at first, I think I heard it was zero. They were just essentially getting it for free to broadcast. But now I think the number came out and it was like 5 or 7 million or something like that. And that's essentially nothing compared to what these rights would command elsewhere or for another sport. And now there's reports that Formula One's trying to get $75 million a year. And maybe they get 50, maybe they get 60, maybe they get 40. But the point is the sport has grown tremendously to the point where they can now request these kind of numbers and demand these numbers. And Formula One's a tricky sport to broadcast because there's no commercials generally, right? So it's very difficult to make your money back. And I think that's part of the concern, right? Is if you start to monetize it too well, then ESPN's like, okay, we probably need to run some commercials. So some fans are worried about that. But I think Formula One's here to stay. I think they've done an incredible job. It's obviously a super interesting sport. And there's a reason why it's been so popular elsewhere in the world. And now that's adopting here. And the last thing I would say about it, actually, one other thing that I forgot to mention that I think was really helpful was social media. Social media obviously has played a huge role in sports globally and our society as a whole. But Formula One was very stringent on social media before. They actually used to fine drivers and fine teams for things that they would say online or if they were tweeting for about certain things. And they've relaxed all those rules. And what you see now is these accounts, the drivers themselves for sure, but the teams even, they drive massive amounts of engagement and impressions. You see tweets. It's not weird to see Lewis Hamilton post something and get hundreds of thousands of likes. And they're really superstars. And the ability that it offers you, similar to Netflix, to get your content from a personnel perspective in front of more people is really powerful. And I think they've done a great job at that also.
And we're seeing that model with Netflix. And I believe the production company is called Box to Box or something like that.
Yeah, Box to Box Films.
Box to Box Films approach, I believe, all of these entities, PGA, ATP, started with the drama with Djokovic at the Australian Open, and Tour de France. So these leagues, entities are learning. Like, this is an incredible fan engagement opportunity.
Well, the interesting thing too is there's two things to me, right? The NFL is obviously looking at this and like, hey, we do Hard Knocks, right? Yeah. Isn't that similar? And it is to a degree. It's somewhat similar. And Amazon does other things too.
Right.
They do the All In series and a few other things. So like, there's other content out there. I think the Netflix partnership, everyone's trying to copy that model. We've seen, you know, as people who create content in sports, it's at a premium right now. Everyone's trying to create original content around sports, and it's super expensive for these companies to go out and acquire and buy, but that's why the demand is so strong. And that's why people are creating so much of this content. So I think we're going to continue to see that. The other two things I think about a lot is twofold. Netflix, eventually in my mind at least, is going to start acquiring the live rights to these, right? So if you're already having Formula One as a series, why not just buy the live rights? Yeah. And you could broadcast them in other countries or internationally or whatever. And it's much more beneficial to you who already has the home of Drive to Survive. And then two, one of the things I know Alex Sherman wrote about this the other day for CNBC, but it's something that I've talked about a lot. And Mike Rabel, when he was on my podcast, we were even talking about was the idea that they would start buying some of these leagues. And the example that we always used was he runs the PLL. So that's essentially why we were talking about it. But the example that we used was the UFC. So the UFC has this massive streaming deal with ESPN and Disney. But when they signed that deal, it was a much, much smaller business. They could have bought the entire business for $2 billion. And now it's a $10 billion business almost and growing. And they would have got a discount, obviously, on the rights. And they would have been able to vertically integrate the business and expand it dramatically. And you can argue, sure, UFC may not be the best image for the brand. And I think that's most of kind of what Alex was saying. But I think we're going to start to see this more often. Maybe it's not Disney, maybe it's not Netflix, maybe it's other people. But I think what we're going to see is the interest in acquiring some of these assets earlier on. So then you can kind of vertically integrate them and own the relationship all the way up.
It really is fascinating that model you're talking about. Of course, Netflix, Apple, Amazon getting involved with all the substantial resources that they have. They could really change the game from traditional over-the-air, traditional legacy networks I always think about that as well. One thing that I see out there is this this feeling that sports is getting away from the average fan. But I think what you just talked about is the access part. Even when I was leaving the Packers 10, 11 years ago, I'm like, you know, this is gonna be an irresistible force versus a movable object here. Because what media wants and fans is more access. What coaches and teams want is less access, right? So I'm at the Packers. We were approached every year by Hard Knocks. We always said no. We just felt like the end of the discussion was, how can this help us? You know, the whole world knows the Packers. So how can this help us? And the answer was, it can't. It can only bring people into our trade secrets and see what, you know, we talk about in meetings, et cetera. Now, for teams that weren't as well known, I understand it. But this is going to be the ultimate, I think, question is, everyone wants more access. We've seen it with Drive to Survive, right? Verstappen and Hamilton, like, I don't need this, screw this, you know? So I wonder where that rubber meets the road there, for pardon the pun, but I do.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And what you're mentioning for people who don't know is Max Verstappen, he literally doesn't participate in Drive to Survive anymore. He's on the show, certainly from kind of images and video they capture outside of his participation, but he doesn't do any interviews. He doesn't provide any, you know, firsthand content. And part of that was the over dramatization of it, right? He said, you guys are making these rivalries that don't necessarily exist. And that's show business, right? That's what Netflix is there for. And that's what Box Films does.
That's The Bachelor.
Exactly. And that's what fans want. Even if they won't admit it, that's what they want. And that's why it's been so successful, is because that's the content that they crave. And again, fans don't admit this because they don't even know it subconsciously a lot of times, but that's what they want. It's the same reason why reality shows are popular and so forth. And I think that that's a good point that we're going to run into this issue where fans want more, to your point, owners want less. But I also think that we're going to realize, and a lot of owners are going to realize, how beneficial it could be, right? So if you take Drive to Survive for an example, again, Mercedes is the top team. They won the championship 7 years in a row, and or 6 years in a row when it first started. Now they've run it 8 years in a row, the team championship. The first year of the show, they refused to be on it. They weren't on it. And then the second year, they said, oh, we should probably be on this show. Because from a commercial perspective, from a licensing perspective, from a brand value perspective, it's so valuable. Perfect. And here's a good stat that most people probably don't know or think about when it comes to Formula One. The top two teams, at least last year, Mercedes and Red Bull, and I assume it's probably pretty consistent year to year, they receive about 25% of the TV time of each broadcast, because they're in the front of the pack. They're the most talked about teams. They're the most popular. So you have 90 million people watching you every weekend for essentially, you know, an hour at least per day, maybe 2 or 3 hours, depending on kind of how the schedule plays out. Right. But your brand is right there. Right. So that's the same reason why Red Bull is essentially, they're an energy drink company, but they don't even make the energy drinks. They're a marketing company. So they essentially put their name on the side of the car. They're not an engine manufacturer. They don't do any of the actual car stuff. It's a marketing play. And they slap their name on there because they know that millions of people are going to see them every single weekend. And that's why if you look at Formula One Drive to Survive, I don't know if this is an agreement or not, but it's very, very, very obvious that Red Bull is the most, willing to participate in it, right? Christian Horner is the principal.
He's a star.
He's the star of the show. They're at his house. They're with his kids. They're with his family. Every interview is of him, right? So I'm assuming at some point Red Bull, you know, is pushing that and saying, hey, let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do this. Because it goes back to how many people are watching the race. How many people are watching the Netflix series? A lot of people. And I think what we're going to find is that from a monetization standpoint, some owners are going to realize how beneficial this could be. And they're really going to start to double down and they're going to toe the line. They're going to give more access to the point where coaches and players get frustrated and want to pull back. And I think you're right. We're going to go through this period where it's just a tug of war between the two parties of giving more and less access, right at the line of maximizing monetization.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's happening in other sports. When I watch the NBA or the NBA playoffs, I'm always kind of, I get my little excitement going when I see, okay, we're going to do a mic'd up or wired, whatever they call it. And then usually it's like a coach saying, hey guys, let's get that rebound. Hey guys, we need to push harder here. Hey guys, stay strong. And then I'm disappointed. And I understand there's kind of a reason for that, where the NBA is saying, okay, we'll do this, but we're going to edit out, you know, where he says, hey, Kevin Durant, get this pick, and Kyrie Irving, come around it. I'm like, that's what you want to hear. You don't want to hear, hey, guys, go get the rebound. So I just think fans are always going to want more. Coaches are going to want less. Owners are going to realize the inherent value of it. Yes. But the football, basketball, baseball operations are going to, you know, they're going to have to buy in. Yeah. I mean, that's going to be a change.
I totally agree. I think it's going to be fascinating, at least over the next several years, to see how that specific dynamic develops.
Yeah. I want to bring this plane to a landing here, keep you under an hour, Joe. It's been great. A couple last rapid fires, as I try to do with special guests, is favorite athlete?
LeBron James.
Favorite team?
New York Giants.
Sorry.
Do I get clarification on those two answers? Let me give the 30-second explanation.
Quick clarification, yeah. Elevator speech clarification.
LeBron James, do I think he's the greatest basketball player of all time? I don't know, but I think he's been an incredible basketball player. He's lived up to every hype and exceeded all the hype that he had coming in, and he's been a great role model and done a lot of good things in the world. So I think he's a tremendous person to look up to when it comes to athlete. The team, I'm a New York Giants fan because my dad was a New York Giants fan. I had no excuse. I just had to watch the games with him, and then you become a fan.
LeBron fits into a lot of what we're talking about because he was the first, unless I'm missing someone, social media scrutinized athlete. And since the decision, right when Twitter was coming along in 2010, it was just, he's been like the Truman Show his whole life. It's really amazing that he has never, in so many words, screwed up. You know, it's just an amazing run for him.
There's very few people that could be on the cover of Sports Illustrated, being called the chosen one at 16. And again, not only live up to the hype, but exceed it. So I give him a lot of credit for that. You know, there's always things that you can criticize people for. But I think that overall, when you look at the full body of work, it's very impressive.
Book. You mentioned a lot of reading, and I know, you know, do a lot of endemic reading. But if you were going to gift a book to your friends, family, students, whatever it may be, what book would that be?
I'll do, given the spirit of the podcast, I'll do a sports book. And one of my favorite sports books is The Score Takes Care of Itself by Bill Walsh. I love it. I think it's great. It's a very, very easy read. I've actually, to your point, given it to a few people for sure. And he's just an incredible leader. He had some incredible anecdotes in there about kind of how he organized the structure of his organization, what he expected of people on a daily basis, and how he turned the team around. They were a really bad team before he got there, right? One of the also the interesting things was certainly there's things around kind of his expectations. I think one of the funny stories in there is like he had a script that he was giving to the receptionist and they had to answer the phone call like that every single day. And he was like very, very, very detailed, almost probably to a fault when it came to some of that stuff. But also his patience. He talks about when they lost the game, I think it was in Miami, he's flying back to California and he's crying on the flight. He's just so upset. Oh, wow. I think he was saying because he thought he was going to get fired. He thought that it was over. He's like, I can't do this. We suck still. And the team turns around and they win these Super Bowls and stuff. And a lot of it is leadership qualities, but I think it's a very cool book because there's a lot of real practical examples in there that he shows and you can literally look back on history and see.
That segues to the next question. Favorite business or sports leader?
Business or sports leader? That's a great question. I mean, he's an easy answer, I guess, off of this, but that's a good one. Let's go with, I love, I don't know if this counts, Michael Rubin.
Yeah.
I don't know if that counts, but
He's down the street from where I am right now. He lives down the street. Yeah.
Does he? Yeah. I don't know him personally at all. So this is not like a plug for him as a friend. I just love what he's doing with Fanatics. I think he realized probably better than anyone else how important incentives were when it came to building a business around sports leagues. And I think what he has done when it comes to working with different sports leagues, giving them equity in the business, getting the exclusive rights, and then building businesses on top of that is one of the most intellectual and fascinating business case studies ever, because they've made a bunch of money. He's obviously made a bunch of money. These businesses have expanded in value, and now it's awarded him the opportunity to do it over a bunch of different avenues, right? Trading cards, gaming, sports betting, et cetera. And I think that for all of the press that he's probably gotten in the last year or two, I think it's just getting started. I think I think we're going to watch him build out this big marketplace, and eventually every sports fan is going to be tied to his business in some way or another.
And last one, favorite quote, whether it's from someone else to sort of impart to your fans, to students, to young people, or your own quote, sort of a favorite piece of advice, whether quote from someone else or from yourself.
I don't know who said this, so I can't attribute it to someone, but I'm sure people have heard it by now. And it's just generally the idea of having strong opinions, but holding them loosely. Hmm. And I think about that a lot, because I think it's important to believe in what you're saying and be confident in what you're saying, right? And know that you've done the work and you've looked at it from a first principles perspective enough to really be confident in your opinion or your answer. But I think that you want to get to a point where you're willing to argue with someone, right? You're going back and forth with someone almost to the point where people are uncomfortable around you. But ultimately, if them or you present new information that is true that the other person didn't know about, you're willing to say, hey, you know what? I was wrong. I didn't think about it that way. You're right. And I think that generally we're turning into a world or a society where people are not willing to do that as much. They want to confirm their bias and they want to be right. Yeah. And I think, again, if you're confident that you've done the work and you've looked at it from the right perspective and you're confident in your answer, then that's perfectly fine. But when someone presents new information, it's something I think a lot about, of being willing to change your mind quickly.
Yeah. It's sort of a corollary quote to that. I don't know who said it either. Something about, if someone tells you it's the whole truth and complete truth, run the other way, or something like that.
Yeah.
Finally, tell everyone where they can find your newsletter, where they can find your podcast, all your channels.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They can go to readhuddleup.com to get the newsletter. And if you want to make it even easier on yourself, you can just go to Twitter at Joe Pompliano and you can find everything. I have a website on there. I link to the newsletter. I feel like I'm constantly posting about the podcast. So you'll certainly run into that at some degree. But that's probably the easiest way to do it.
Joe, I'm really enjoying our growing professional and personal relationship. This has been great. Encourage everyone to listen to me being interviewed by you on a recent podcast this week. And then, of course, we'll have you back as a regular guest if you're willing.
Of course. I'm happy to do it. I always appreciate talking to you. I tell people all the time that you're the level head when it comes to the sports business side. You're able to remove the emotion from a lot of these things and just say it how it is. And I respect that for sure.
Thanks for joining the Business of Sports, Joe. It's a great conversation as always.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed that wide-ranging interview with Joe Pompliano. He's someone that I admire. He's got a newsletter that's doing great. I want to get to that level with my newsletter and all the information he provided. A colleague in the sports business world that I think is doing great things out there for our space. That'll do it for this week's edition of the Business of Sports. Please follow my newsletter, andrew-brandt.com. Andrew-Brandt.com/SBL, Sports Business League, if you want video from me every day and weekly gatherings. Of course, Andrew Brandt on Twitter, Andrew Brandt 2 on Instagram, AB719 on Clubhouse. And please give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Share this podcast with a friend if you would. And we'll be back next week with another edition of the Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.